I envision a statue of me with no umbrella, just like sopping with a coat on, you know, hood somewhere.
Arms erected like in, they are now.
Yeah, erected in this town somewhere someday.
Yes.
For getting the umbrella size reduced.
And on the inscription underneath, it will say, Kurt was all wet.
That's right.
Hi, welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
And I'm GeekWire civic editor Monica Nicholsberg.
We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we get to report each day on what's happening around us in tech, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. Coming up this week, we will talk about Amazon employees openly defying a new company policy, a new plan to tax tech companies to alleviate homelessness, what a Seattle startup leader's car purchase says about the state of transportation, and why umbrellas have become a lightning rod on Amazon's campus. All right, Monica, let's jump in with our first story. Amazon employees are being openly defiant. Is this correct? Did I read this headline correctly?
You read it correctly.
All right, tell us the backstory.
The backstory is a group of Amazon employees that call themselves Amazon Employees for Climate Justice have been organizing for the past year or two to try to pressure their employer to take a bolder stance on climate change and enact more progressive sustainability policies.
But didn't Amazon announce a big climate action plan last year?
They did, actually, the day before many of these employees walked out to join the youth climate strike.
And Amazon knew that they were going to be walking out when it made that announcement.
They did, but they said that these programs had been in the works for a long time. The point is that some of the most valuable, coveted tech workers at Amazon are using their leverage to put the pressure on because they don't think the company is moving fast enough to deal with this crisis.
All right, so tell us the latest.
The latest is Amazon reportedly told a couple of these employees that their jobs could be in jeopardy for violating the company's corporate communications policy, and they updated the policy. Basically, it says you're not allowed to talk about internal company business without going through PR first. And rather than having a quieting effect that seemed to energize these employees more than 350 of them published statements with their names on them, talking about the company's sustainability work, the need to do more, and criticizing this communications policy itself.
So effectively, their jobs are at risk here?
Theoretically, but the point of grouping together of this many employees putting their voices out there is that it would be really untenable for Amazon to take widespread disciplinary action. And I also am sort of skeptical of whether Amazon actually would take any action to begin with, because this is tech. You know, there is a talent shortage. These white collar workers, like I said, are very, very valuable. Companies compete aggressively to recruit and to retain them. They invest a lot of money in training them. And that's why this new wave of employee activism is so interesting, because they do actually have quite a bit of leverage.
So what do they want in addition to what Amazon has already announced, apart from perhaps rolling back this, what they consider onerous communications policy? What do they want in the realm of the climate?
They want Amazon to stop working with fossil fuel companies. There are a number of contracts in which these companies use Amazon's cloud services and other computing abilities to, in some cases, you know, help them more efficiently extract fossil fuels. So that's one component of it. The employee activists also want to see the timeline for reaching carbon neutrality accelerated, and they just overall want Amazon to be a real industry leader on sustainability. They feel like the company has been kind of reactionary to their criticism and to public pressure, but isn't using its financial and other resources to come out at the front of the pack on this.
So how did this end up? Did the company take any action? Did they say anything about these employees publicly taking a stand and openly defying this new policy?
They issued a statement saying that they felt their corporate communications policy was in line with other companies and that they weren't going to allow employees to disparage the sustainability work of their colleagues. And it's clear that that message resonated with some of the employee activists, because in a lot of their statements, they said, "We're so proud of the work that's been done so far. And more needs to be done because it's not proportionate to the crisis."
What you said about the push to have Amazon stop working with big oil is really interesting, because a couple of weeks ago, Microsoft announced its own climate initiative that went well beyond what Amazon has pledged. Microsoft is actually trying to go carbon negative. In other words, take as much carbon out of the atmosphere as it puts in each year, but then also go back retroactively and do that for as long as they've been in business. And one of the things that Microsoft was criticized about at the time was that very thing. Environmental activists said, yes, this is one of the most bold steps that a company has taken. And yet, Microsoft still could go further. It kind of reminds me of what privacy advocates are asking Amazon and Microsoft to do in terms of not working with the US government and different law enforcement agencies on facial recognition, where both companies are saying, no, these are our customers, we're going to keep working with them. It's very similar. It's like the customers themselves are the most prized possession of these companies. And while these companies might do things to improve the regulatory environment for facial recognition or their own policies for the climate, the customers are the third rail.
That's right. It's a really tricky time for these companies, and there is some dissonance. Microsoft is a perfect example. They came out with this bold plan, like you mentioned, the same week that they sponsored an oil conference. That was reported by Vice. And it's just one example of the conflict here, especially in technology where the customers are extremely important, probably the most important thing, certainly to Amazon. But the employees are also very, very important. They're valuable. They have choices. It's a tight labor market, and these companies can't function without that talent.
So far, at least, this is not hitting Microsoft and Amazon on the bottom line, because both companies this week reported blockbuster earnings. Both of them saw their market values rise even further above $1 trillion, believe it or not. And this, so far at least, seems like it's not impacting their ability to do business.
Right. We talk about this a lot. What does the techlash really mean? Another example is Axios had a report this week that Facebook has just continued its, you know, unstoppable growth despite years of scandals and settlements with regulators. So I think it's going to be hard to predict what the real world impact of this will be unless the bottom line does start to be affected.
All right. Speaking of impacting the bottom lines of these tech companies, there was a new proposal in the Washington State Legislature this week that brought back to life one of the most controversial issues of the past year. And we'll talk about that coming up next.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT Certs Included.
Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg. Monica, you had another story this week out of the Washington State Legislature about a new tax that was proposed at the state level, but targeting regional companies in a really interesting way that we can get into. Give us the gist of this one.
Washington state lawmakers are considering a new regional tax that would raise more than $121 million a year from some of the biggest employers in the Seattle area, like Microsoft, like Amazon. And the goal is to alleviate the homelessness crisis.
Okay, this is really interesting because this has been a longstanding debate. I know that there was the head tax proposal from the Seattle City Council that was passed with much the same aim, to raise money through taxes to fund services for the homeless.
Right. At a high level, the idea here is Seattle has some of the wealthiest people in the world, these huge tech companies that are generating a lot of money and really changing the landscape of the city. And at the same time, this housing affordability and homelessness crisis that we can't seem to get our arms around. And wouldn't it be great if we could figure out some sort of taxing mechanism to direct some of the wealth that's been generated by this tech boom toward addressing this crisis?
If I remember correctly, one of Amazon's criticisms of the Seattle head tax was that it was not a comprehensive regional approach. So this looks like at least a regional approach. I don't know if it's comprehensive. So are they fully on board with this?
They're not commenting publicly, neither is Microsoft, but I kind of get the sense that the business community is going to get behind this. It would be difficult to oppose the solution that they had called for during this kind of ugly battle that occurred over the head tax. There are some key differences in the structure of the taxes, too, that we should probably talk about, because that gets to the heart of the criticisms of the head tax and what I think will be support of this new plan.
What are those?
So the head tax would charge per head. It was a tax on a per employee basis at large companies. And the business community said, well, that's just a tax on jobs. The policy that's under consideration now is a payroll tax, and it only applies to the payroll expenses of companies that are above $150,000 per employee. So in other words, if I have 200 employees and 50 of them make more than $150,000 a year, then their salaries are what I'm taxed on.
Interesting. Okay, so the idea is it does not penalize job growth.
Yeah, that is the idea. It doesn't apply to companies with fewer than 50 employees unless the majority of those employees are making $150,000 a year. So the goal here is to tax high salaries.
Interesting. I loved reading your descriptions of the legislation because it reminded me of some stories from the past in some of my past jobs covering some legislative actions where it's written in a really vague and yet very specific way. One of the things was that the tax would not apply to a, quote, comprehensive cancer center, the characteristics of which clearly are drafted to refer to the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, but not by name.
Right. It's like a Voldemort situation.
Yes, exactly. Which is really interesting. I don't know why legislatures can't just say the name of the institution that they're clearly carving out from something like this. I don't know. There must be some legal slash policy reason, but it makes for some very entertaining reading and some fun process of deduction to figure out exactly what they're referring to.
Yeah, absolutely. And with this one, I do get the sense that it came together pretty quickly and we're in a short legislative session. So if it's going to move forward, then I think it will move very quickly and things could be changed throughout that process.
So have any other tech companies spoken out in support or against this?
Expedia came out and said that they're behind it, that this is the type of solution to this crisis that they support. The others are a little more circumspect, but I wouldn't be surprised if they do come out with a statement or potentially even in support of the bill in the next few days or weeks.
Well, Monica, if folks out there think a tax is controversial, just wait until everybody hears our next topic. Umbrellas. That's coming up next. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop.
Monica Nicholsberg.
And we're joined in the GeekWire studio by Kurt Schlosser, Geek Life reporter. Is it raining out there, Kurt?
I haven't been out yet today, Todd. It doesn't... From my view doesn't show me any rain.
You're working that hard. Nose to the grindstone in
That's
the newsroom.
Right.
So I ask you that question because you had by far the most read, the most popular, the most talked about story on GeekWire this week about a subject near and dear to the hearts of many people in Seattle, in the tech industry. One of the most important topics clearly happening in the city right now. Umbrellas.
Wow. Yeah, I may never go outside again after this story. Or maybe I should go outside every day if those are the types of stories that are going to resonate. Umbrellas. You hit it on the head. And I did not get hit on the head, but I went down and attempted to at the headquarters for our friendly neighborhood tech giant, Amazon. And just I observed, as I put it somewhere, the tech giant in our midst, not midst. And it wasn't a misty day. Man, it was pouring last week. And we had sort of seen some bubbling on social media that the size of Amazon's umbrellas, these free umbrellas that they provide for employees and anyone visiting their campus, they were getting a little blowback on them because they're golf size and they're orange and white. And if you're down around South Lake Union or the Denny Triangle area where the towers are and the spheres, they're everywhere. And they sort of clog up the sidewalk and they give this perception that anyone who is using such a thing can't possibly be from here because, Seattle has this sort of mythological anti-umbrella stance that only tourists and only transplants would dare use such a thing in the rain.
So this has become a full-blown controversy, a very Seattle-style controversy. People complaining about Amazon's employees walking around with, as you said, these golf umbrellas. They're not mere rain umbrellas. These are large umbrellas on the streets, sometimes impeding others from walking down the sidewalk.
They kind of look like a little tent that you would carry over you for a sense of scale for anyone out there who hasn't seen these things.
Yeah, that you could get three of your coworkers underneath one of these things easily. And I was down there for an hour, hour and a half. I kind of circled the block a few times. A lot of people running between buildings without a jacket on under one of these, carrying a laptop, maybe huddled over their phone, sort of ordering up an Uber. A lot of people coming back from nearby restaurants with food or headed out to get food. The company says the intention is to, well, beyond keep yourself dry, to cover you and maybe a friend as you head to a meeting at another building.
Now, some journalists get public policy changed, law changed. They win Pulitzers for uncovering things that are going to make meaningful differences in other people's lives. And on the latter, I think you've succeeded here, Kurt, because I predict in another 12 months, come next winter, Amazon will have abandoned the golf-sized umbrellas and shifted to normal, ordinary, personal umbrellas.
So you two have lived in Seattle longer than me. Are there any circumstances under which you would carry an umbrella?
I cannot remember the last time I carried an umbrella. And to your point, Kurt, this is a point of pride. One of my favorite lines from your story was, quote, "Hardened Pacific Northwesterners wear rain jackets with hoods, thus keeping their hands free to pat themselves on their drip-drying backs."
So good.
I have used an umbrella at a kid sporting event because there's nothing more miserable than watching kids sports when you're wet.
True.
So standing on a soccer sideline, I've been known to get under a friend or co-parent's umbrella. I've never used one to come to work or to commute around at work. I was saying earlier, I think that the weather that sort of I observed last week was a little abnormal. And someone raised this in the comments on my story about how the sort of a misty sort of constant Seattle rain doesn't usually require that sort of coverage where you're trying to avoid getting absolutely soaked. Also, our style doesn't really dictate it. Some people in the comments were, well, if I wear a suit to work or my fancy shoes are going to get all wet, then yeah, I want an umbrella to protect all that. Well, that's not Seattle either. Most people are wearing some sort of, or at least, here's another culture story, Todd, the sort of prevailing style sense in Seattle is that you could throw a coat on, a raincoat, get a little rumpled, go to work, and no one's going to notice. So apparently not only is our attitude toward umbrellas changing with 50,000 Amazonians in our town, but so is our sense of style.
This controversy is the most Seattle thing ever. Not only is it about rain and umbrellas, but it's also about feeling offended by someone else taking up more than their fair share of the sidewalk.
Nice.
I lived in New York before this, and it is like umbrella anarchy. Everyone is carrying one and they're bumping into each other. Nobody cares. It's just kind of like, I'm going to take as much sidewalk as I can possibly get because someone else is going to try to take it from me. And it was actually in New York that I first realized that umbrellas are a terrible technology, not when I moved to Seattle, because one of them in a freak windy storm inverted and gave me a black eye. And
whoa.
I stopped using them then. I was like, it's better to be wet.
Well, I think that's a good point because, you know, in New York, that sort of mass of humanity and the sort of the commuter lifestyle of every man for himself and getting down the sidewalk or getting into the subway, that's been there forever. In Seattle, this is a relatively, decade-old phenomenon where all of a sudden it feels really congested around certain parts of the city. So you throw big umbrellas into the mix that have never been there before, and all of a sudden people are like, what is my town becoming? What's next?
The umbrellas are a symbol of Seattle's decline.
Yes.
Well, that is ultimately what this is. And Kurt, you actually called out a comment that I know resonated with you and resonated with other readers.
Yeah, this commenter said, it's not the issue of using an umbrella. It's how friggin' gigantic they are. To me, these umbrellas are everything that's wrong with Amazon. No consideration for anyone but themselves.
And it is also everything that is wrong with Seattle in that we're all sitting here complaining about it in a somewhat passive-aggressive way. Has anybody gone to Amazon and maybe petitioned them and said, hey, just make them smaller?
Well, that would ruin all the fun because we'd have nothing to complain about.
I envision a statue of me with no umbrella, just like sopping with a coat on, you know, hood somewhere.
Arms crossed, erected like in, they are now.
Yeah, erected in this town somewhere someday.
Yes.
For getting the umbrella size reduced.
And on the inscription underneath, it will say, Kurt was all wet.
That's right.
All right, Kurt, thank you very much for the report from the streets of South Lake Union. And speaking of the streets of Seattle, there was one other interesting development this week in the transportation arena, it again was one individual decision, one individual symbol of a larger trend. So we're going to talk about one person here, but I think it's indicative of what's changing in the landscape of transportation. Ben Gilbert, who is one of the co-founders of Pioneer Square Labs, announced on Twitter that after 4.5 years, he bought a car. And the reason that matters is he had written publicly on GeekWire and elsewhere about the fact that he was able to use ReachNow, Cardigo, Uber, and Lyft, and good old-fashioned shoe leather to get around Seattle without owning a car, and really was able to make it much more economical. But it no longer is the case.
This is really fascinating because, like you said, Ben's personal story tracks with the broader story about transportation in Seattle. The city has been a real testbed for transportation tech companies to try out new things, which has been really cool for us over the past few years because we were the first American city to get a broad dockless bike share program and all of these free-floating car sharing services like you mentioned. The problem is when a private company is given license to move into your city and develop a part of the transportation infrastructure and people become reliant on it, they make real decisions like getting rid of their cars. And it's not like this is a taxpayer-funded type of service that has some oversight there. If that company goes belly up or decides that the economics of it don't work, which many of these car sharing services have, all of a sudden an option is gone.
And the specific news is that Cardigo is leaving the United States, and that followed ReachNow and Lime in terms of taking their cars out of Seattle. And Cardigo, as we've reported, was the original ride-sharing service. Is that the right? I always get those phrases confused.
Free-floating car sharing.
Free-floating car sharing as opposed to ride-hailing, which is what Uber and Lyft technically are. I wonder if this is going to become a trend where people like Ben, who were able to get around by their wits and their smartphones, are suddenly forced to go back in time and buy cars.
I think it's interesting because he points out that he lives close in to the city. He lives in Capitol Hill. And, you know, if you look around at the sort of the desire for more density, that housing is sort of built in so that you can commute without a car or get to work without a car. But he also notes that his desire to get outside of the city was impacted by not having a car. And part of the intrigue and the attraction to coming to Seattle is that there's so much around it that is desirable. So if you want to get to the mountains to ski or you want to go jump on a ferry, you know, some people think you need a car to do that.
Monica, do you think the scooters are actually going to happen? Because there was the story that Lime took the Lime bikes off of the streets, supposedly temporarily. And I know the city is talking about the scooter share pilot, but along the lines of this trend, I've started to become somewhat skeptical about whether that's actually going to happen.
Well, the city is developing a pilot for scooter sharing, and several companies, including Lime, have said they definitely are going to apply for the pilot and want to launch here. The caveat to that is this is a pretty untested thing, just like some of these other transportation services that we've been talking about. The new mobility space has a lot of enthusiasm around it and a lot of venture capital flowing into it, but not a lot of proof that the underlying economics work. So I think we will see scooters in Seattle. I don't know how long they'll last.
And maybe Ben will try those out and take his car back, decide that he can just scoot from place to place. And then you can get on the scooter with your umbrella and you'll be perfectly fine in the rain, right?
And then you win Seattle bingo.
All right, so that's it for GeekWire this week. Don't forget, go to geekwire.com to check out all of the stories that we talked about. You can also find them in the show notes on this podcast. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Kurt Schlosser.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire.